Before we resume, Christine, Mills, would you put up on the board there that wonderful quote that you told me at the break? Interdependence and abundance? Wherever you are, yeah, there you are. It's a wonderful, we live in an interdependent abundance, which you read somewhere. And I think, there you are, yeah, I think that is the, that is a wonderful thing that will give you a touchstone and a mantra to work with this book. Before we begin with actually looking at a few quotes that I picked out that I think are particularly challenging and the turning points in his argument in these first two chapters, do any of you have any responses or any questions to the material I presented or any things that you bring with you about the book as you've read it so far that you want to get off your chest? Yes, Pat.
I would love you to speak just for a minute on it and compare and contrast the unity of consciousness of, say, the Buddha, who was about, 600 years before Christ,
Very much the same, I think. That once again, we have this new birth of consciousness. And what I've always found useful, and another thing that happens when you begin to access unitive consciousness in your own being, it sets up the history of cause and effect in a whole different way. We like to think that what's earlier causes what's later. What it actually works like in the world is what's higher calls into being what's lower and sustains it. So when you have teachers that are at a similar level, they often think in the same way. And rather than going around the world religions trying to sort them out doctrinally, it is much more interesting, as we're discovering in spiritual paths, to sort them out praxeologically, or in other words, by what do they teach at certain levels. And basically, almost all world religious traditions at their lowest level are rigid, superstitious, rule-clad, esoteric. And as the level of the beings working in them gets higher and higher, you find the understandings converge. And I find that rather than just beating a dead horse myself about saying that Jesus was the only Son of God that ever lived, that, you know, just drives other people in the family of world religions nuts, and is clearly in and of itself a statement that comes from the egoic level of conscience. Can you hear why? Because it's based in comparison and contrast. Whenever you hear a statement that compares and contrasts, you know you're dealing with egoic consciousness. So that kind of a statement is coming from a consciousness that's less than the consciousness that Jesus himself came from. Okay? So, what we can say in a sustainable way is that Jesus came from the very highest level of spiritual consciousness that's ever been able to manifest on the planet. And there are others that share the same level of consciousness. And I'm not going to go to more or less, because you can't divide truth into more or less. When you get it, you get it. You get the whole nine yards. 2 and 2 is not 3.5 in Buddhism and 3.78 in Christianity. So Jesus, the Buddha, Ramana Maharshi, Krishnamurti, there are beings who come from such a high level of understanding and compassion that they just call your mind up to a whole different level. They put you in touch with what's highest in you. And I think that rather than wasting time trying to figure out whether Jesus was better than the Buddha or got it from the Buddha, is to say, hallelujah, that the divine abundance sent to us Westerners. And don't forget, we were set on this path of being Westerners. God sent to us this wonderful teacher at the highest possible level to allow us to manifest these truths within a Western form. So does that settle it? Okay, great. Yes.
Now, you said you could still say the Nicene Creed.
Yes. I sure can. Because I learned the Nicene Creed from that great spiritual teacher, J.S. Bach. And I learned to do it not as a Thomistic, scholastic, theological argument, but as a piece of mystical poetry. And I can say these things. I mean, I love the Christian story. Once I finally figured out, and I actually learned this when my nephew fell in love the first time. And he wanted to say to his girlfriend, "I love you very much. I love you more than anything I've ever felt of love before." But he didn't have words for saying that. So what he said is, "I love you forever. You're the only one." Which is, once again, the egoic operating system's download of this feeling called love. Once I got that, I could see that the Nicene Creed is a love song written in the language of egoic consciousness. And so that all these statements about only and exclusive, really, if you can hear them, and that's where J.S. Bach helped me hear them, because he heard them, he helped me hear them as music, are statements of people. It's a direct transmission of people who stood in the presence of Jesus and said, "Oh, wow," that they'd never seen anything like this before. And if you can hear in the Nicene Creed that, "Oh, wow," that this is a master who can do all these things, who puts us in touch with God from God, light from light, who rose again, who sits at the right hand of the Father, in other words, who is instrumental in all reality. I can say that. That gives me hope. That gives me joy. I mean, I think the Nicene Creed is one of the most mystical and beautiful and uplifting parts of my faith. I just don't go to the place that says, you know, who would ever say, because Bach is right, Mozart is wrong. You know? I mean, that would just cut out some beautiful music. So that's my way of working with it. For me, there's absolutely nothing wrong in the Nicene Creed once you realize you're hearing something through the very highest of egoic operating system ears, and once you have the charity to not make it an exclusive either-or admission to the Jesus Club sort of thing, and make it a love song. Yes, Al?
Yeah, I guess what I wanted to say is that if I can find myself in the Nicene Creed, in Christ, then it's easier for me to say it. But when it's exclusively about a person who's frozen in history and can't in any way relate to who we are, I mean, in Christ, in us, aren't we God from God, light from light, from true God begotten, not made, one of these, you know, with the source through whom all things are made. I mean, can't we find ourselves in that? I mean, when it's written and said to be exclusively about something we could never claim or do, it's, you know, for me, that's difficult.
Exactly. And the problem is that the West, particularly post-Thomas Aquinas, has put everything in these scholastic categories, these propositional categories. So we think when we listen to the Nicene Creed that we're hearing an argument, you know, that, or we're hearing a package that we have to relate to by "I agree" or "I disagree." You'll hear it a little bit differently if you go into the Eastern Orthodox Church, because it isn't put in that scholastic, dialogical, agreement, argumentative way. But still, you're right. I think that one of the things that Dharma Dharmarshi can help us do in our book is to hear ourselves in the Nicene Creed. Because it does try to hold up a bit of the vastness of the scale of the universe. And I think that where we get the vastness of the scale of things in Christianity is in the mysticism of our sacred poetry. And you see, these are these arguments I'm going to make for why we don't have to throw Christianity out. We just have to bring ourselves along to a new level of hearing. Yes?
I think one of the things that makes it difficult for us to do that with the creed is that English is virtually, so far as I know, the only one that professes our belief in the plural rather than in the original singular.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't place our individual selves because we have to account for others around us.
Yeah, exactly.
Credo.
Yeah. Credo is I believe. I believe. Yes. Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff here that we have to work with. But I'm going to encourage you and to come back again. Don't try to fix the problems with your mind. Okay? It's because all you do is split your Catholicism into your radicals and your conservatives. That's what will be the only outcome if you try and fix it with your mind. What you have to do is go in and awaken this level of your being that we're talking about, and awaken it so deeply and so profoundly that you just, what comes out of you just falls out of your actions. Yep?
How do you deal with then questions like the resurrection and the assumption and the story? How do you deal with that?
Well, that's exactly the question that he throws at us, isn't it? How do you deal then with the resurrection or the assumption or any of these things? Yeah. Well, the way that you deal with it, first of all, is not by asking the question true or false. Okay? Put a moratorium on true or false. Okay? Because that will lead you guaranteed to some heart-broken places. And ask instead the question, how is it true? And I want to tell you a little story here that may sound like I'm way off base, but but this actually has to do with your question. I received my first communion by accident at the age of 20. Totally by accident. How is this possible? Good Catholics probably can't imagine it. Well, I grew up in one of those arms of Protestantism as a Christian Scientist going to Quaker schools, where this wasn't a part of our practice. And the way I happened to receive it was that by that time I had fallen in love with music. And I was with my college roommate in London, Ontario, and saw that the choir from London, St. Paul's, London, England, was going to be singing at St. Paul's, London, Ontario. And they were doing the bird mass in three voices. And I said, hop, diggity, dog, we're going. So I was in such musical rapture that I didn't even realize that there was a lot of talking between the parts of the music. And it wasn't until a rather stern-looking gentleman stood in front of our row and looked at us that I realized I was being ushered into a communion line. My mother had said in her Protestant way some nasty things about this sacrifice that only Catholics did. But I was more afraid of the guy than I was of eternal damnation. So I said, and my roommate, who was raised Roman Catholic, said, just follow me and do what I do. So we got down to the altar and knelt, and she put up her hands and said, do it like this. And then she said, don't chew. And then when the cup came along, she said, don't touch it. And I was like, how can you drink it if you don't touch it? With your hands. So I tried, and did all that awkward drugging that everybody does, and was walking back to my seat thinking, well, that's that. And I was about two-thirds of the way back to my seat when I realized, that's that. And it wasn't like some big Paul on the road to Damascus sort of thing. But I knew in some sort of inner knowing that I met my match. And that something that had been missing from my life for 20 years had miraculously appeared. And what was even more amazing than the fact that I knew was the fact that I knew that I knew. That I had no catechism. I had no sort of expectations whatsoever. That's why I take it seriously. You know, nobody had told me it was either good or bad. Nobody had explained what it was about theologically. So I was like a total virgin. And yet, something in me said, yep. And through that initial encounter, I met, in a very profound and intimate way, Jesus risen as activating principle within my own heart. And there's been many, many times afterwards I've told people over and over that if I could throw over this Christian path, I would do it in a nutshell. You know, like the Sufis have all the fun, or the Buddhists with their wonderful bubbly guru and their nonviolent path, why should I have to be stuck in this path that seems so spiritually immature and which has caused so much damage? The reason is because I met my risen master in the bread and the wine. Now, what the point of this story is, and I'm not trying to talk about myself personally, what I'm trying to say is that there is something in you, too, that knows, and that knows you know, and that in your heart of hearts, you do meet a living Jesus. That's why you're on this path. And that it has nothing to do with all the creeds, with all the things that people teach you, with all the, it has nothing to do with having gone through any of your formal training. It's in you. And it's a living Jesus. It's not a dead Jesus. It's not a Jesus that went away and is playing ping pong until the second coming. This living Jesus lives in your heart right now. Or to put it more in a different way, you live in his heart, as does everything. And for me, the vastness of the cosmos that Dharmic Omurchu is trying to explain for us is nothing more but a tiniest drop in the bucket of the vastness of the heart of Jesus. Now, this is not something I would say exclusively like a Buddhist. You know, it's the heart of the world. Jesus is, for me, the heart of the world. Okay? So, what I'm saying here is simply that once you meet the risen master in and through meeting the depth of your own heart, which I would propose brings you back to meditation as the most sustainable practice. Once you meet that, once you learn that a guru of Jesus' magnitude is not dead, and that time and space are veils, then everything settles down a little. And for me, what resurrection, ascension, and all of these things are primarily about is that they match the configuration. They're sort of what Jesus did in the relatively brief time he had on the planet was to model and walk the places in a human journey that in a most unique and compelling and direct and quote-unquote efficient way moves through the breaking open and liberation of our hearts. You know, in that relatively short time he had, he didn't found the Jesus Christ Institute of Spiritual Transformation and give certification and degrees. He took on the most broken, the most difficult places in a human journey. Not because God was mad and needed a human sacrifice. Forget all that stuff. Not true. Appalling. But because God, in God's love, knows that this human condition is difficult and necessary. knows, and not necessarily through punishment, but knows that because within these conditions of finitude and boundaries and love and loss, that divine love becomes extremely precious, that it glows and manifests itself in a certain way, that flavors of divine love that can only be manifested in finitude are manifested here. Things like steadfastness, fidelity, tenderness, vulnerability. These essences, these subtle flavors of divine love demand finitude to express itself in, which is why this planet is here, in my take. It's only one of many, many, many cosmoses. But because God knows it's hard, and because God so loved the world, he sent his Son, the fullness of unitive love, to model and walk with us through these tight places. So he experienced abandonment, betrayal, all these nasty things, physical pain, mental pain, loneliness, all these things that we intuitively shy away from with everything that we have. He took them on in order to take us through them. So for me, resurrection, crucifixion, the Paschal mystery, ascension, are objectively true as inner blueprints of what God is doing in the world. And that the kind of mean-spiritedness you sometimes find out there in the world now that says, well, you know, Jesus didn't really die and get risen. He only faked it, or he probably died at Masala, or that he was only a kind of, you know, recreation of the Osiris myth. All that stuff that doesn't take Jesus absolutely seriously, doesn't take absolutely seriously our own reality. So things exist at many levels. So, you know, it doesn't bother me particularly whether on a certain day in May of that year we saw the bottoms of his feet as he flopped up. Because I absolutely know from the inside the ascension of Jesus, what it was, what it is. And I know what it feels to live like inwardly in my being, in that place between the physical form being gone and the spiritual form, you know, the Holy Spirit, not fully fleshed in yet, to live in that hush. So don't abandon your story in despair. Just take it deeper, okay? And trust that these things that the Church has pointed out to us all these years are the sacraments of your own transformation, have got truth in them. It's just a different kind of truth than what you thought. It's not an exclusive truth, a true or false truth, a literal truth. But it's the deepest kind of spiritual, psychic soul truth. Okay? Does that help at all? Yeah?
You answered this for people like me who have been raised in a very dogmatic, fearful kind of Catholicism. How does one let go of that fear if you're going to allow yourself to grow beyond, or just what you said?
Okay, well, that's exactly why I told you to start every session of reading this thing with 5 minutes of meditation. Because it's the only known way to let go of fear. Basically, what will happen is that as you practice, and remember what I said, just let go, let go, let go. If the thought comes up, you let it go. You don't judge it, you don't react with it, you don't fix it. As you practice that letting go, what you're actually doing sacramentally is practicing what Jesus did in the Garden of Gethsemane. Not my will, but thine be done, O Lord. You practice letting go. And as you practice letting go, little by little, what you find is that you can stand there right in the presence of fear without it undoing you. And that's where you have to get to. so that you can not push fear away so that it doesn't happen, but so that when the fear comes up and you can feel that painful awkwardness of, oh my God, maybe I really am going to hell, you know, rather than running back to the old teachings of your youth that will relieve that feeling, or just bowling through and saying, bah, that's all, bah, I'm angry, but I'm angry, you know, rather than trying to change it into anger, just, okay, the fear is there, you sit in it, you let it go, you let it go, you let it go. And so you basically neutralize its negative charge by bringing to it your conscious presence in trust. Alice?
Along these lines, just this past week, I was reflecting and thinking that on that subject of fear, that only somebody who has done what you're saying, I think, can say fear not. And it made me wonder, as a human, how fearful Jesus wasn't. Like, that was his big thing, fear not, fear not.
Fear not, fear not.
And even in the garden, at the end of his life, confronting a certain level of fear. So, and it's what you say, not fighting it, but standing there and coming through it. That is a great grace to be able to live with fear and not have it overwhelmed.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Even Mary Baker Eddy said,
yeah,
divine love casts out fear.
Yeah. Right, and she got it from a good source. Yeah. Perfect love casts out fear. It's equally true that perfect fear casts out love,
mm-hmm.
which is the quandary of exoteric religion. But if you would become fearless, and this is the only way that we can be mature enough to deal with information like this, because information like this that falls into fear causes trouble. So you need to be able to learn to sit in the presence of your own fear and sit in the presence of your own conditioning without trying to relieve the tension by running back into the mind. Okay? So that takes mastering this. Just let it go. And when we do that in centering prayer, we do it for 20 minutes. You can be fearful for the entire 23 hours and 40 minutes left to you in the day. But for this time, we practice this. So we bring conscious presence to it. And as you learn somehow how to neutralize that sting of your own fear, then you become gentle enough inside that you find that the fear tends to disappear. Because the trick is that once you have learned to shift your normal sense of identity into unitive or heart perceptions and keep it there, you will have a way of dealing with your fear. Because fear doesn't hang out at the unitive level. It doesn't become incapacitating. So, you know, I realized one day when I got a flat tire in my car while driving across that stretch of Utah desert between Aspen and here, getting dark, nobody around for miles, and I'm like, I'm going to die, what am I doing? You know, the cell phone doesn't pick up. Yeah, you know, you're just getting into a full panic attack. Here I am. God's still here. Nothing can fall out of love. Let's see what will happen next. If I live or die, I am the Lord. All those things. When you can reach that level of your being, nothing can unseat you. And it comes and it goes and it comes and it goes. But if you're working on that as a practice while you're reading this book, you'll be rapidly growing into what he's teaching you. Okay, let me just start with a couple of little passages that I'd like to throw at you that you may want to look at. The first being on page 12, where he says, and this is actually a paragraph, more than anything else, the new insights into cosmology, particularly those emerging in the last quarter of the 20th century, provide pivotal information on what we need to incorporate into our understanding of tradition. We live in a universe in which our co-creative God has been overtly at work for at least 15 billion years. We share in the creative expedition of our unfolding species for at least 4 million years. In fact, Niffen dates the evolution of the mind back to 6 million years ago. A tradition which fails to acknowledge and incorporate these timeless unfoldings betrays the elegance and creativity of God. Well, you know, this statement, I actually had a conversation on exactly this point with my then 5-year-old grandson when I took him on retreat at New Kamalvali Monastery last Christmas. And he sat there and said, "Grandma, I'm confused." He says, "The Bible says it starts with Adam and Eve, but where were the dinosaurs then?" You know? And you watch the kid trying to juggle two paradigms. And I think more and more kids are doing it. And the way we have tended to do in Christianity, I think, and perhaps this is mean-spirited, but we go every Sunday to what I call the Christian theme park, where we walk through the gates of this great spiritual Disneyland and enter a smaller time frame. And so within that, we all do this of, well, it began with Adam and Eve, and then there was this and this, and we think that the religion started with that these were the first human beings. And we derive our theology from that. And then we go out in the rest of the week and we talk about quarks and atoms and dinosaurs and evolution and the first species arising, the Cro-Magnons and all that. So we're dealing with two different things which we aren't relating. And Omurtu says we have to find some way of relating, rather than just entering our Christian theme park on Sunday mornings and then dealing with a whole different scale of reality the rest of the week. Anybody have any opinions on what he said? Yes. Is that Tom back there?
Yeah. The problem is that you're not approaching the Bible as poetry.
Mm-hmm.
It's your own words.
Exactly.
Right. Because, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth and so on. Our story of creation, if it's read poetically, is big enough.
Yeah. Exactly. And if you want some wonderful poetry, read Brian Swim's The Elegant Universe. Brian Greene's On the String Theory. If this isn't mystery. But yeah, so for me, this is simply an operational problem at this point. It's very clear that in the same way that I answered your question earlier about Jesus, that Adam and Eve, that story, is inwardly true. Some people think it actually relates to, it's a mythological way of talking about the birth of egoic consciousness. Remember? So all of a sudden they're walking along in a non-discriminating unity, and all of a sudden, oh my God, imagine! Wow! But in other words, it talks about a fall into a different kind of perceptual filter. And I think it works really, really well to talk about it that way. So that rather than taking the myth and trying to make it history, which has been the thrust of theology, that what you really do is to allow it to be myth and to say that it preserves in a kind of wonderfully authentic and inspiring way exactly what this book is talking about. That there was a time in the history of the human race as we evolved as a species when we became self-conscious, and as a result of that fell into a different density, not using fall to mean that we sinned and got punished, but that we came really and consciously into a different realm of understanding. Okay?
Yeah.
without saying that anybody was to blame or that it was bad or that a nasty God, you know, put you through something, I don't believe that it works well to put the emphasis on that story on disobedience. I think we need to keep our emphasis in that story on the fact that in myth we're trying to talk about something that did happen objectively in the history of our common human family and its journey to consciousness, and that it had some major results. Maybe this was the birth of the dread patriarchy that he's talking about, because after that, war and division did begin. And Cain and Abel, if nothing else, is a beautiful archetypal story of what happens when you look at the world through comparison, contrast, divided minds. So, but I think, on the other hand, we have to say that to make these statements already puts us out of sync with what comes to us in tradition. And you have to remember that Teilhard de Chardin lived and was writing only 60 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, his latest books were written in the 50s, mm-hmm. 50s, early 60s. That's not so long ago. Probably most of you in the room were well through your journey through junior high school by then. And remember that the church cut him off cold at the pass,
mm-hmm.
you know? And remember that when you turn to the great canons and liturgical devices of our tradition, when you turn to scholastic theology, when you turn to the monks, when you turn to the mystics, when you turn to Bernard de Clairvaux, you're not going to find a cosmology that's compatible with what we're reading here, because it hadn't been invented yet. And so you will find that Christianity, if you go back to your classic stuff, you're going to be working with resource materials that don't yet acknowledge what we know now. Well, now this is so easy to solve. It's so easy to solve. It can be solved liturgically. All you need to do is, in our Christian practice, in your small, not your main Sunday masses, but in your liturgy, in your centering prayer groups, in your contemplative Eucharist, you create new chants, new antiphons, based on some of the songs and some of the vastness. You begin to read, you know, a day by day with Teilhard de Chardin, and let him be some of the epistle, again in small groups, so that we begin working with the symbol structure and the image structure of this vastness. It's not a problem of sabotage. And the church is not going to lose a thing by allowing its context to broaden, to begin to use resources more than, you know, the canon didn't close in 1200 AD. We got all sorts of wonderful stuff that we can incorporate. So I think this is one of the places where I'd encourage us and our children to become poets and artists of the Spirit. They made a Nicene Creed in 325 AD. We could begin to make a piece of sacred numinous Nicene Creed in 2006 AD. What do we believe in? Not to deny or replace, but to dance in sacred poetry what we believe in. Okay? So these are opportunities. And I encourage your group to have fun with them. Okay? So, okay, anybody have any questions on that? Yeah, please.
I often get the impression institutional church wants the theme park to continue, and continue to bring people in, but not to relate to each other. When people relate, they start doing things together. I really haven't seen Rome doesn't like that. When people relate too much, they get all these ideas, and they want to say, we don't want any more empty rituals.
Yeah.
If we wanted to say something.
Exactly. You know, and it's been amazing to me just how willingly like sheep led to slaughter, so much of Catholic Christendom has happily gone back to the, you know, to the increasingly rigid control. You know, but in a way, I asked Bruno Barnhart, you know, that wonderful monk and prior up at Big Sur, who maybe someday you'll get to talk to in this group if you haven't. I said, why is it that human beings are so reluctant to be weaned from their rules? And he says, well, we always prefer a manageable complexity to an unmanageable simplicity. You know. Now, it was the same problem that Paul was dealing with. You know, he was trying so hard to, you know, if you've got this rule and it's got 500 bits to it, but if you really work hard and keep all 500 bits, then you know you're saved. But to have only one requirement. In the Gospel of Thomas, there's another line about this. It's the sixth saying. And his disciples said, do you want us to fast? Should we give alms? Should we abstain from certain foods? And Jesus said, stop lying and do not do what you hate.
Wow.
Those are the only two, and this is once again the Gospel of Thomas, probably A.D. 60. Okay, so I see Alice making motions in the back. I do want to call your attention to, before I end, and challenge you. I think I've already talked and set something around the second of my three challenging statements on page 18, the sense religion is disintegrating because it has served its purpose. I think I've given you a way of perhaps contexting that within the axial consciousness. I'm sure you'll want to talk about it more. I encourage you to come out as you can, on up to the spiritual paths events up at Santa Barbara, because we're trying to work an interspirituality which really allows people in various religious paths who are on basically the same wavelength spiritually to share, to work, to grow, to help midwife some of the art forms for the next hall. Yeah?
Which part of page 18?
It's the second full paragraph on the page where it's in italics. And here we need to confront the great delusion. Nobody is causing the breakdown, and it is a tragic waste of energy and resources playing such a futile defensive game. Religion is disintegrating because it has served its purpose. You may want to start talking about that more in your small group, so I'm going to get out of town before I... I do want to just show you one other thing that he says that you may have missed, and in the second chapter on religion as sacred place, where he's saying, page 30, he actually starts talking about it on page 26, but he talks about, in the first full paragraph there, he has a sentence that says, the dualistic opposition of sacred and secular, of earth and heaven, was unknown up until a few thousand years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's doctrinal. I think that's absolutely on target. Then he goes on to say, and I think this is very interesting, and toward the bottom of the page, he says, as I have already indicated, this is, I believe, what the theology of original sin is really about. Not some flawed state that existed from the beginning, but the distaste for the created order that we ourselves developed with the evolution of patriarchal consciousness. Now, I think that is profoundly insightful. In other words, what has come to full bore in our tradition as this theology of original sin, that we did something bad and therefore really is an accurate psychological witness to the fact and a way of putting into words that at some point in our emerging consciousness as human beings, we began to experience an alienation from the planet. And I think this comes exactly back to what I was saying earlier, because alienation, separation, is part and parcel of the egoic operating system. So it was as we made this evolutionary leap so we could begin to think, what came along with it was this incredible sense of separation. You know, when the froggy on its froggy pad suddenly discovers it's not the froggy pad. Mm-hmm. And it may have to worry about whether the froggy pad is going to wither up and leave it dumped in the drink. Then, so what we're celebrating there is a tragic, necessary, painful evolutionary step forward. But it's interesting that all of the world religions that we know at this point, that grew up in this axial period, every single one of them you go to begins by saying something's wrong with the human planet. It's either Maya, illusion, in some of the Eastern religions, exile for Islamic Sufism and for Judaism and for what he talks about, punishment, or finishing school for our wings. But so much we can't get any religions nowadays, except maybe some of native spiritual allow of it, that will just allow us to settle down and be at one with our beautiful, precious planet. Yes?
I was wondering if egoic operating system, rather than being an evolution in things, more of an innate thing that we were created with, and that at some point it was truly activated as part of the evolutionary process and a necessary evil to get where we are now.
You're exactly right. And some of the best Ken Wilber, quoting a fellow named Ernst Neumann, who was a student of Jung, both say that the interesting thing in our, when you look at consciousness in the micro and the macro, is that the history of our human race as a whole and the stages of consciousness is precisely recapitulated in each human being. So that each stage that we go through in our own development has been lived as a sociological whole by an early anthropological layer of our being. So there's a complete resonance there.
And maybe you can apply to systems like the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
They have, you know, had a lot of pure childlike state at first.
Yep.
And then it went through its egoic.
Yep.
You know, and now the egoic one is falling apart.
Yes.
And its new birth will come and eventually be more Christ-like.
Exactly. That's very hopeful, and if you can remember to work with that. The Catholic Church is not the baby thrown out with the bathwater, if you can bring the wisdom to this that it calls. So that's a wonderful comment. Alice, what is it that you're going to do here at the end of our time together?
That Cynthia was here to begin us on this really important journey. We have really, those who have been coming to Word and Life for many years, we didn't just start with this, we've been building towards it, but nonetheless, it's probably going to be the most challenging study we've done so far. And I think Cynthia named it very well and the difficulties, but gave us hope. We talked a little bit about this last week, and there's a continuity here. I do think this study will be even more destabilizing for us than we had before. But in the spring, we're going to go into a study of Beatrice Rousseau's book called Radical Optimism, and we're going to go in more deeply to the contemplative life and going inside to the root of our being. And then from there, who knows where we're going to be going.
Yeah.
But that's going to be an important part. But I want to thank Cynthia. We are just enormously blessed that she happened to be here now.
Yeah.